Right now it's time for Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm really delighted to be bringing you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll discuss big cats, conservation, and more with our guest zoologist, Alan Rabinowitz. As always, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune. This is the Rain Stick Orchestra with Waltz for a Little Bird here on Talking Animals. This is the Rain Stick Orchestra with a piece called Waltz for a Little Bird to kick off today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Alan Rabinowitz, zoologist, conservationist, field biologist, and head of Panthera, a nonprofit organization devoted to protecting the world's 36 wild cat species. We'll find out about his work, about Panthera, about the status of those wildcat species, and more when Alan Rabinowitz joins us in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments when we're speaking with Dr. Rabinowitz at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. First, though, it's time for our animal news items and announcements. I want to first tell you that Florida Voices for Animals, and perhaps other groups, has scheduled a demonstration against the Derby Lane Greyhound Racetrack in St. Petersburg. It's going to be held this Saturday, August 14th, from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. They recommend, if you want to participate, to arrive 10 to 15 minutes early to find parking and to walk to the track. And also recommend bringing water, sunscreen, hat, sunglasses, umbrella, etc. They will provide signs. Of course, you can make your own. So, again, that's this Saturday from the Derby Lane Greyhound Racetrack in St. Petersburg from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Also coming up, it's the Spaghetti and No Balls Benefit Dinner, Big Drinks and Silent Auction, put together by our friends at ACT, Animal Coalition of Tampa. This is going to be held Saturday, August 21st from 5 to 10 p.m. And it'll be a dinner from 7 to 8, silent auction from 6 to 8. This is all going to be at the Wellswood Center. Can't announce the prices on air here, but there will be a cash bar, silent auction, raffles, door prizes, and more. And all proceeds benefit the ACT Spay-Neuter Clinic and help make it possible for us to end pet overpopulation in our community. More information, actampa.com. Or calling 813-250-3900. So, let's now step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. Actually, well, let's go ahead. That's fine. All right, so let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy as always. This is Bill Burr with... some might call rescue dog, some might call pit bull. Either way, it's on today's Comedy Corner here on Talking Animals.
So I got a dog recently. That's a big thing in my life. I went down to the pound and I got a free dog. That's how I say it. I don't say I rescued a dog. All right, it's obnoxious and it's not true. Sick of people doing that. She's a rescue. Yeah, I rescued her. Really? Did you pull her out of a burning building? Did you jump in a river with your wingtips still on, with no concern for your own safety? Or did you just go down to the pound and get a free dog? Stop acting like you had to take out a couple of guards, crawling on your elbows, using hand signals. Dude, you ever go down to the pound, they're just giving the dogs away. They don't even do a background check. They're just like, you want them? Get out of here. Who's next? So, my girlfriend actually, to be honest with you, got the dog while I was traveling. I was in a different state. My girlfriend got us a dog, right? Classic female move, you know? That's just a 10 to 15 year commitment. Why would you include me in that decision? So we're Skyping. I go, well, let me see the dog. I thought she got some little cute little chihuahua or something. She pans around and I'm looking at like this hellhound. Yeah, I'm like freaking out. Like, is that a pit bull? Please tell me you didn't get a pit bull. And she's like, it's not a pit bull. It's a, they said it was a mix. Mixed with what? Another pit bull? Look at that thing. That was brutal. Should have seen it. Looked like I've been doing pull-ups its entire life. Front paws were still taped up, and shadow boxing. Teardrop tattoo. It's a pit bull. But here's the funny thing. I fell in love with the dog. I know a lot of people don't like pit bulls because they ate a couple of guys. I get it. It's been some issues. But you owe it to yourself at some point in your life to walk down the street with a pit bull. I'm telling you, people just get out of the way. It's awesome. 3-4 blocks away, they see me coming, they just start crossing the street. I love it. My whole life, I've looked like Ron Howard. Okay? I've been mugged repeatedly. But the second they see that four-legged P90X body coming down the street, oh, yeah. It's the greatest dog you could ever have. Having a pit bull, it's like having a gun you can pet. It's tremendous. I'm out of time. You guys are a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
All right. That was Bill Burr with a piece called Pitbull, taken from his most recent Letterman appearance. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page. Like us already, will you? And our Twitter page. Please follow us. Plus, there's a space to subscribe there to our email newsletter, so we can keep you posted on forthcoming guests, program news, and more. That's all found TalkingAnimals.net. It's nearly time to speak with today's guest, Alan Rabinowitz, so let me outline a few things about him. As I mentioned earlier in the show, he's a zoologist, conservationist, and field biologist who grew up with a severe stutter, which isolated him as a child, and he took refuge and solace in hanging out with animals, recounting this history on the Colbert Report a few years ago, famously nearly brought Stephen Colbert to tears. So Alan is also president and CEO of Panthera, a nonprofit devoted to protecting the world's 36 wildcat species, and his latest book, Life in the Valley of Death, The Fight to Save Tigers in a Land of Guns, Gold, and Greed, will be issued in paperback on September 7th. So, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing DJ at WMNF.org. Let's welcome Dr. Alan Rabinowitz to Talking Animals. Are you there?
I am here.
Welcome. Thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals.
My pleasure.
Well, gosh, and there's probably several hours, frankly, of topics I'd love to discuss with you, and yet we're only allotted about 20 minutes here, so I'm just going to aim for some small patches of material that might form some kind of representative mosaic of your big story and your big work. I'd like to sort of go back a little bit at first, though, to the Bronx Zoo, or at least the big cat house there, seemed to play a pivotal sort of soothing, if not healing, role in your childhood. At this point, with everything you've done and learned and taught and the global perspective you've developed, I'm particularly interested in your view of zoos now. I mean, good, bad, both?
Well, I've never been a big fan of zoos, I have to tell you. Zoos are one of the factors that got me into thinking I had to do something to help get the animals out of their cages in the first place. I felt I was trapped in the cage of my own head, and I would see these huge, powerful beings, these jaguars and tigers, trapped within these small concrete cages. Now, zoos have gotten better. Zoos try a lot harder, at least those in the United States. But I can't believe that we as a culture, we as a race, actually need to put animals in cages in order to learn about them. I'm not a great fan of zoos, really.
Right. No, I kind of suspected that'd be the case. It just seemed like, as you kind of outlined, you know, perhaps, you know, paradoxically, they did seem to, you know, form an important part of your childhood, but you know, seemed like
they did in a paradoxical way, as you say, because it was like seeing somebody in a prison, and I could empathize with that powerful animal locked up in a prison through nothing of his own doing, and I was locked in my own head and couldn't speak through nothing of my own doing.
Right, so there was that kind of kinship there. So this topic may sort of roll into one I think is really essential for us to explore, especially maybe on a show like this, which is conservation. I mean, in a moment, I'm hoping I could ask you to tell us a little bit about Panthera, but first, I'm interested to hear if you feel the word conservation itself has some troubles, either by being used so widely and indiscriminately that its meaning has become fuzzy, or that it's been sort of co-opted for sometimes nefarious purposes.
I think those are great questions. I think that there's nothing wrong with the word conservation per se. It's the perception that now has kind of taken over our field in exactly the way that you've described. For one thing, I think when people mention conservation, they believe that it's full protectionism, and there are some conservationists who are strict protectionists. But in my field, one of the ways we are trying to save all the big cats, and the way that Panthera strives to save tigers and jaguars and lions, is to say that we have to work with the local people, the communities on the ground. These animals need areas where they're protected, just like human beings need a house which is their own personal sanctuary. But outside that house, they either have to live with the rest of the populace at large, or they will not survive. So there's no way that conservation of something like a tiger can really take place unless we're taking the discussion out into the human landscape and how these animals can live with development, with people, how people's lives can be bettered, and let tigers survive at the same time. Many people don't view conservation as having that kind of open-mindedness, but all the people in my field who accomplish the most are those feeling that particular way.
Sure. Well, and I want to delve into that more, but I guess just sort of just as an example for those listening, what I might mean by co-opting that term for nefarious purposes. I mean, one thing that comes to mind quickly, especially in this area, is the Ringling Center for Elephant Conservation, which, of course, is just basically a hatchery for more circus elephants to stock their road troops. But let's touch more on conservation in sort of the way you mean it. And on a related note, I suspect that employing genetic corridors are probably the most serious, maybe typically effective gambit to saving the big cats. Could maybe just tell us a little bit about what exactly are genetic corridors and how they do work?
Well, the easiest way to describe to people what a genetic corridor would be simply to talk about it from the human perspective. If we think saving animals cannot be thought of as just finding an area that is protected, keeping those animals inside, letting them only breed with each other, and thinking that will work for those species, especially if they're big, if they're tigers, if they're elephants, if they're any big, large, wide-ranging animal, that will not work long term. That would be akin to telling a population of human beings that they can only find their mate, be it female or male, within a very limited several block range of their house. And beyond that barrier, they can't mate with anybody. They can't have children. They can't raise a family. So what would eventually happen if that were to take place is that those populations of people would become very, very inbred, as we know.
Sure.
Some of the worst genes would come out, and that would have what happens with animals.
So that's one of the chief virtues, I guess, of having this much larger swath of land for, in this case, tigers, let's say, to live and roam and be tigers.
And it's not protected land. It'd be the same. A genetic corridor for a human basically would be somebody like myself who, because of airplanes, I was able to go and work in Thailand, and I met my wife in Thailand, and now my family has a lot of mixed kinds of genes.
Mm-hmm.
A tiger would be allowed to roam through designated areas, which might be a cattle ranch, a rubber plantation, a tea plantation. It would be privately owned human landscape where the people are making money, they're doing what they want to do, but the tiger, the occasional tiger, just like mountain lions in California, are allowed to roam at the edge of their land.
Right. Well, let me just let our listeners know, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with zoologist Alan Rabinowitz, whose latest book, Life in the Valley of Death, The Fight to Save Tigers in a Land of Guns, Gold, and Greed, will be issued in paperback on September 7th. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. And Alan, this discussion now of tigers, and especially relative to genetic corridors, reminds me that in the animal welfare world, if not beyond, you routinely hear that there are the sort of the phrase seems to be 5,000 tigers in captivity in the U.S. more than exist in the wild. First, how accurate is that, and what does that really mean? What are the implications relative to the work you do, and the passions you have to what that often bandied about phrase really means?
Well, it's even a more shocking number than that. Okay. There's actually approximately 13,000 tigers in captivity, probably 5,000 to 8,000 of those in the United States. But 13,000 tigers in captivity, and we think there are less than 3,000 tigers left in the wild. Now, there is a good side to that.
Wow.
As bad as that sounds,
yeah.
Because once an animal is in captivity, it really can't just be taken from a cage and put back into the wild. It doesn't happen that way. It's not that simple.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do have then in captivity and alive is a genetic pool. We actually have realized from the captive population how much we've lost genetically from the wild population. So that actually, even though there are 3,000 tigers living today, the tiger that's alive today is not the same tiger that was alive 50 to 100 years ago. Over half of its DNA is actually gone from the wild.
Mm.
Now, could we use captive animals and try to kind of reinsert that? To an extent, yes, we could do that. That would be a possibility. So there is an advantage of having kind of an arc, if you want to explain it that way, but frankly, that's not how these animals are being treated. Having 13,000 tigers in captivity, mostly for people's own pleasure and personal use,
yeah,
is not a great thing in this world.
Wow. Well, this might be the exact moment to ask you if you could maybe just explain a little bit about Panthera, its mission, and the work you do as its president and CEO.
Well, I spent almost 30 years working on big cats as well as some other endangered species like the Sumatran rhino and certain bear species. But my love has always been the large cats. That's what really attracted me as a child when I had a severe stutter. So for the first few decades of my life, I actually worked in a division of the Bronx Zoo in New York called International Conservation. It had nothing to do with the zoo itself per se, or bringing animals back for the zoo. It was for trying to set aside protected areas for cats. But I found that even in a well-meaning organization like that, it was just too large, too corporate, too burdened by other agendas. I couldn't move the ball forward as fast as I wanted to in my limited life to really save the big cats. So in 2006, we started Panthera, and Panthera is the world's largest cat conservation organization dedicated only to saving all 36 species of wild cats, with particular emphasis on the great cats, which are the most endangered: snow leopard, tiger, jaguar, lion.
And how with these presumably kind of the added focus and resources that Panthera has sort of brought since it was started, really obviously only not you know 4 years ago. I mean, is it too soon to see kind of a quantifiable change based on Panthera's efforts, or are you already seeing encouraging results in that way?
Well, fortunately, we didn't start, although it's a new organization, it brought together. What I did is I decided to create a think tank. I wasn't trying to become large and compete with the other very large conservation organizations, which I think is burdensome and actually is not moving as fast in conservation as they should be doing. So I brought over to Panthera all of the world's top cat experts, either on our staff or on our advisory board. Mm-hmm. And these are basically like me. They're silverbacks. They're not really. I've got a lot of young, passionate people working for me, but I also have older people who have changed the face of cat conservation in their careers and yearn for an opportunity just to be all together in one place. So since we have organized together as a group, we've really been pushing the agenda much faster.
Sure.
On things like the Jaguar Corridor. We've been scaling up on conservation. We don't do it in small bits. We do it on a global level in a way that no one has ever attempted it for these cats before. And we're making incredible progress.
Yeah, I would think if you're consolidating those kinds of experts with that kind of experience, that the movement is forceful.
It really is. It is forceful. Money's always an issue, especially since we started at a very bad time.
Sure.
In our economy. But we do it with what we have. It's funny. In the world of conservation, although you always need more, having more should not be an excuse. You can always do a lot more with less. We can push forward on most of our agendas with whatever we have.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, that's the organizations that sort of, you know, face that music sooner and respond, obviously, you know, just are much, you know, leaner and faster and get those results. Yeah. Again, this is Talking Animals. My guest is zoologist and conservationist Alan Rabinowitz, whose latest book, Life in the Valley of Death, will be issued in paperback on September 7th. To join the conversation, have a question or comment for Dr. Rabinowitz, please call 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. So you've made a couple different references in the conversation to having a severe stutter and early on and you know, sort of preparing for the interview. I've looked around and seen all kinds of, you know, things you've said or things you've written, of course. And among the things that sort of interest me is some of those are stuttering gave me my life. I'm pleased I was born a stutterer, I think at one point you said, and that's how I got where I am. Maybe you could sort of elaborate on those sorts of statements.
Yeah, it's a strange statement because while I can say now that I truly do believe this, that stuttering has been a gift to me and that it put me on the path that got me to where I am, I wouldn't wish my childhood and stuttering on anybody because I had a severe handicap. I was treated back then. I mean, I'm now in my mid 50s. When I was a child, stuttering, the New York City school system didn't quite know how to deal with it, and I was basically from kindergarten till sixth grade put into special ed classes which all the other kids called the retarded classes. So my entire image of myself mirrored through the adult's eyes was as somebody who was broken, who was retarded, who was, and there were other things they didn't understand at the time, like ADD and dyslexia.
Sure.
We were all put together in those classes.
Right.
And I lived in my own head because I knew I was normal in my head, but I couldn't get the words out. I had severe stuttering blocks.
Sure.
And I stopped even trying.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Stutterers can do a couple things, and they don't stutter. One of them is sing because of the airflow.
Yeah.
And they can talk to animals because of the psychology of it. No expectations, no judging. And I went home and I would talk. I would go into a dark closet and I would talk to my little New York City animals, green turtles and lizards and chameleons. And that's who I lived my life with. And I developed from early childhood, from five, a very strong bond with these animals.
Yeah.
And I realized that the reason people mistreated animals, even without realizing it, they would euthanize their dog because it was sick, flush a turtle down the toilet because they were tired of it, is because these animals didn't have a voice. If the animal screamed, "Please don't do that to me," or started crying, people wouldn't do a fraction of what they do to animals.
Absolutely.
Their lack of a voice was why people treated them that way, the exact same as what I was going through.
And then these notions, I guess, then can't help but take on sort of additional poignance when people learn, as I did, that you have a son who stutters. Now, I assume he's kind of a supreme beneficiary of your experience and all the things we really learned in those ensuing years about stuttering, and is probably having a very different childhood, I would gather.
Yes, very, very different. For one thing, now with the computer, we didn't even have computers when I was younger, and I was the only stutterer I knew. I couldn't go and chat with other stutterers. Mm. I couldn't reach out for any kind of a help. And they didn't know stuttering was genetic at the time. They thought it was purely psychological. Now we know that it has a genetic neurological component,
sure,
and mostly in boys. And sure enough, my own son started stuttering. And while initially it was like a knife into my heart,
yeah,
because I didn't want him going through anything I went through, I also immediately started him on things that I never got started on, which was how to develop the tools I use now, which is why I still stutter. I'm a stutterer, but I'm using a lot of tools to be able to speak to you the way I am now. I could embed those tools in him as a very young child first speaking, and now while he will always be a stutterer, he can speak, he can be a fluent stutterer.
And also, I would think he must be struck on some level. I don't know how old he is, but just by all the speaking engagements and the interviews you do, I mean, I would think he would take great great comfort and inspiration from that, just within his own home.
He does, I think. He's 11 years old, and like a typical 11-year-old, he will come and hear me give a speech, and he'll be very proud, and then at the end he'll say, "Daddy, you know, you stuttered like 5 times in that speech. You should have controlled it better." I was never even allowed to talk about stuttering because my parents wouldn't acknowledge it.
Oh, wow.
So,
yeah.
It's a very different.
So it's free and open, and he's got a stuttering scorecard, it sounds like.
Yes, stuttering scorecard, exactly.
Yeah. Well, we're in our final moment or two here, Dr. Rabinowitz, but I know there are some folks who have been calling in, and I would like to at least get one on the line and in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Alan Rabinowitz.
Hello.
I'd
like to ask the doctor a question about a close relative to all the cats around the world. We have a Florida panther, and I was wondering how many there are left and what we could do to help them, like what you're saying about expanding their habitat. Thank you.
Well, actually, that's a great question. You know, the first cat I actually ever saw in the wild was a Florida panther when I was hiking with a girlfriend in graduate school in the Everglades. At that time, they were down to horrific low levels, and there was every evidence that they would just blink out until they finally made the right decision, in my opinion, to bring in outside panthers, not so much worry about what the genetic or racial variation was, mix them, and now they think that the existing panther population, although I know several people working on it and they don't have a firm handle, they think it may be maybe a few hundred in there or maybe 150. But what we are trying to do right now is actually extend, which is very difficult, as you can well imagine, having asked that question for that area, extend the available habitat up along the southeast corridor through human landscapes. It doesn't mean it has to be pristine, fully protected habitat. It just has to be landscapes where male dispersers, young dispersing males or females, travel, can get through and try to establish. In this case, it's not going to another population. It would be they would have to reestablish a population in, say, a good area in Georgia or one of those other large wild landscapes. The possibility does exist. Unfortunately, not enough people are focusing on it because the land developers have a much larger voice in all of this than the conservationists do.
Ugh, ain't that the constant struggle in this regard? Well, Dr. Rabinowitz, we're sort of just at the very last seconds of our time here. Just two quick things. One, I guess I'd be almost remiss if I didn't at least briefly mention your appearance 2 years ago on the Colbert Report. I mean, I'd just be curious to know what your reaction to the gigantic gigantic sort of reaction that appearance generated. I mean, online, all kinds of chatter. I'm sure it's probably mentioned to you often as it isn't even now. But it just seems like one of those singular moments in time. For 6 minutes, it just seemed like it kind of had an explosive impact.
It's true. It actually went viral for a little while.
I
was shocked. I was at first told not to go on the Colbert Report. I was warned that he would tear me apart. I would not get any of my message across. I loved Colbert. He came in and saw me before the show. He said, "Look, this is about, it's going to look like it's about me, but everything I do and say will enable you to get your message out." Now, he ended up being given a whole bunch of very strange questions by his staff. When I was on camera and he was off, he sat there scratching out the questions and basically just asked me. He loves animals.
Yeah.
And he just asked me from the heart. And that's why when he asked me those questions, none of which had been scripted, it affected him greatly in a way that he didn't intend, nor did I.
Yeah.
And it just was a very wonderful moment. He's got a terrific, he's a really incredible man, and that show is terrific.
Great. Yeah, no, it was just remarkable. And yeah, just like often if you sort of abandon your script and your prearranged questions, you know, something like that happens. I just want to leave you with one email that among some others that have come in, but it says, "Great show. Thanks. I'm a big fan of Dr. R. Have most of his books and videos. Jaguar is one of my all-time favorite books. It was a great thrill to visit the scene of the book in Belize a couple of years ago. Saw Jaguar, Prince, and Scat. Looking forward to the new book." And again, the newest book is Life in the Valley of Death, subtitled The Fight to Save Tigers in a Land of Guns, Gold, and Greed, coming out in paperback September 7th. Dr. Alan Rabinowitz, thank you so much. Of course, there's just, you know, hours more of things I would love to chat with you about, but this is all our time for today. Thank you for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Great. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. All right. I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. There'll be a prize, a copy of Alan Rabinowitz's latest one, Life in the Valley of Death, in hardcover in this case, though, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies the somewhat relevant animal tune. Let's name that animal tune on Talking Animals. And we've just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. The program airs twice a month, specifically the first and second Wednesday of each month. So we'll return Wednesday, September 1st, when our guest will be Thomas French, Pulitzer-winning, prize-winning reporter who wrote a fascinating new book, Zoo Story, providing a behind-the-scenes look at the operations of the Lowry Park Zoo. And then our other guest next month on September 8th will be Alec Baldwin. Yes, you heard correctly. I hope you'll join me for both those shows. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby McKenna. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. We'll take the question off the air. We're closing out today's show, as always, with an animal tune. This is new music from Crowded House with Falling Dove on WMNF Tampa.